issuer is soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
The Sanity stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
I don't know his number. His Skype address.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Kindness, right, and waiting pressures.
News scoop.
What we need to know.
News scoop.
What we want to know.
We got news scoop.
What we think we know.
Till freedom is a rumor.
News scoop. What we need to know.
News scoop.
What we want to know.
We've got news scoop.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the ball we...
On the one hand, there's the public's right to know. On the other hand...
Thank you very much. Hi there. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on PRN, hoping to begin some interviews in a moment or two. We're Michael Albert, who is a very well-known activist, economist, speaker, and writer. During the 1960s, he was a member, like I was, of SDS. He was active in the anti-Vietnam War movement, particularly at MIT. He's the co-editor of ZNet and co-editor and co-founder of Z Magazine. He also co-founded the South End Press and has written numerous books and articles. He identifies himself, according to this Wikipedia profile, as a market abolitionist and favors participatory planning as an alternative. He developed with Robert Harnell the economic vision called participatory economics. He's done a memoir called Remembering Tomorrow, From SDS to Life After Capitalism. And he's going to be joining us in a minute. If I can somehow organize this, I'm going to do so. I need you to try to help me here with another song, if we can, so we can actually get this organized in a proper way. Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC, NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Byron, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message. Managing the message.
Trying to turn politics and the serious issues of our life into entertainment.
Managing the message.
Thank you, sir.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
In wartime, seeing is not always believing.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Mr. Secretary.
Just follow up on this question a little bit.
I thought I answered that.
Media war.
Be either with us or you're against us.
Outcome is assured.
What about Al Jazeera in that, publishing those gruesome pictures of dead soldiers?
I think there's something that is culturally...
Hi, Danny Schechter here on Media Channel Radio. Pleased to be with you for one more week. I'm joined in the studio by my guest, and he's going to be on with me in 1 second because we're going through the process of actually plugging in the headphones. And when the headphones are plugged in, you're going to be able to hear me, and he's going to be able to hear me. We're having a few technical problems, but we're solving them. But first, we want you to meet a journalist that I've known for quite some time who's been very involved in investigating 9/11 as an issue in the 9/11 Commission. Ray, could you introduce yourself? Tell us about your film, and then let's talk a little bit about the challenges of trying to deal with this issue in a journalistic way.
Hey, Danny. Thanks for having me on.
I'm not hearing you. Not sure why.
Hey, Danny, thanks for having me on.
Okay, here we go.
All right. Yeah, with help from a firm called Global Vision that you were a part of, I've produced a film called Press for Truth back in 2006.
Your name, where you're from, and all of this information.
Sure. My name's Ray Novoshelsky, and I'm originally from Chicago. Started working on a film in the mid-2000s following a group of women from New Jersey who had been apolitical prior to the attacks but suddenly found themselves with a passion issue after their husbands died in the World Trade Center. And they fought for a number of years to get the 9/11 Commission called for the express purpose of trying to fix, basically to find what problems existed in the U.S. government prior to 9/11 and fix any of those problems so that this wouldn't repeat in the future.
And what did you find in terms of, you know, two things? What actually was not being reported, and why? I mean, you actually, these women, I remember them, the Jersey girls, they were called.
Right.
Their husbands had died in the World Trade Center disaster, and they took it upon themselves to become amateur investigators, to look into what was happening. They compiled files, and they began to actually lobby for a 9/11 commission, a real inquiry. And you met them. They were very impressive. They were very dedicated. Obviously, they had suffered a great loss in their personal lives, but they also felt it was important for the American people to know what had happened and what was involved. And so they started with a zero knowledge base, and I guess you did too.
Yeah, I did, and I was kind of shocked by some of the things they had found. This was sort of 9/11 was one of the first major events to take place after the internet had become as common as it had. And so what we found as far as your question about the news media was that that a lot of important things had been reported but hadn't become part of, let's say, the mainstream media narrative. And so the common digester of news on the street would probably not pick up on a lot of these important facts because they would sort of come out in, you know, page 6 of one newspaper or on someone's blog over here. But if you kind of put the pieces together, you could see there was a real problem in terms of accountability post 9/11 with looking at all of the different failures in almost every agency and actually holding people to account. And of course, the big sticking point for the 9/11 widows is that not a single person was fired. When we began looking at the CIA, there was sort of one pre-9/11 screw-up that was considered the mother of all screw-ups. And it was this thing where a group of CIA agents inside the Bin Laden station had gotten wind of a major al-Qaeda meeting that was taking place in 2000. They surveilled it. They found out two people from that meeting were heading to the U.S., and they, for whatever reason, did not tell the FBI and the White House about this for about a year and a half. And Jane Mayer from The New Yorker calls it, you know, one of the greatest intelligence failures in U.S. history. It's sort of this notorious case now. But you see that after 9/11, it became known that this failure occurred, and there was an opportunity to hold people accountable for those failures. But the U.S. government was in a weird position at that point because they were in need of anybody who was an al-Qaeda expert, anybody with a knowledge base on al-Qaeda. And this was a relatively, you know, prior to 9/11, anyone who was sort of crying out from the wilderness that al-Qaeda was going to be a problem for the U.S. was considered a little bit eccentric. And so the number of folks who were experts at al-Qaeda was a really small group. And what So basically, the government had a tough choice where it was like, well, sure, the people in the bin Laden office, this group of 50 people, really screwed up before 9/11. But now, are we going to fire our only al-Qaeda experts? We need them. We've got a war on terror we're starting. And so that sort of points to one of the fundamental problems of the post-9/11 era, that the people who failed the most, where there was the most incompetence and bad acting within the government, those people got promoted because they were the only experts about al-Qaeda, and they have since continued to run things, you know, to the present day.
So what you found was this sort of bureaucratic nightmare, agencies competing with each other, individuals within the agencies competing with each other. And yet very little of this was actually being reported. The mistakes that were being made were being glossed over, because all we were hearing about were the different, fear-inducing possibilities and potentials for another attack and the like, and why we have to be strong and why we have to respond. At the same time, the structure of, you know, of our intelligence operations were really caught off guard by all of this, or didn't know how to process the information they had.
Yeah, and I mean, because the people in the CIA decided it would be better to sort of that this not become public, that their people can be able to stay in their position so they could continue this fight against terrorism post 9/11. Because that decision was made, the result of that cover up was that we now have all those same incompetent people sort of still running our war on terror. And I think what we've documented is that we found in 2011, a couple years back. 3 years back now, we discovered the name of this woman who, it turns out, is, as far as we know, still running the global jihad unit at the CIA. So she's been involved because she was let off the hook for 9/11. She ended up being involved in developing the torture program, in mistaken renditions, in bad intel that was used to push for the war in Iraq, and on into the present, into the drone attacks, the present day, the targeted kill lists. And so basically, if you take people who've already failed in a massive way once, you cover up for them and you let them continue at their jobs, as they grow in power, they tend to become at the center of further and further scandals, you know.
But how do you cover an agency that's top secret, that doesn't communicate with you, that doesn't want you around asking these questions, and a media that doesn't seem to really want to press too hard either?
Right.
You know, isn't that part of the challenge here? Even if you're not a conspiracy nut, so to speak.
Right.
You know, you don't have a theory about what actually happened. You're just trying to get some facts. You're trying to find out and explain certain contradictions, which it seems like you were trying to do. Mm-hmm. How do you go about doing it as a journalist?
Yeah, so what we ran into, I think you were there when I spoke at the HopeX conference a couple weeks ago, and we kind of talked about this one problem we ran into, which is that we were independent journalists. We were doing a sort of an investigative podcast, as well as writing an article for Salon about this pre-9/11 failure. And we basically come to deduce the name of this person who was at the center of the 9/11 failure, and now she's the head of the Global Jihad Unit.
And of course, this is a big no-no, because isn't there a law that protects the identities of intelligence agents? Are you going to challenge that? I mean, Edward Snowden, leaked documents illegally, you know, because he believes. But you aren't an insider; you are an outsider.
Well, not only had no one given us the name, we had actually deduced it. And then began using it in interviews, and nobody ever corrected us, so we started to feel more and more confident about this. So we wanted to give her the chance to speak for herself. So we emailed CIA, and we let them know we're about to release this podcast, the Salon article. It's going to name this person, and here is what the evidence that we have uncovered about her is. We'd like to speak with her. And I immediately got a call from the media spokesperson, Preston Golson, from the CIA.
From the CIA, okay.
Yeah. I was warned ahead of time by some journalist colleagues that as soon as I send that email, be ready for a quick response. And boy, my phone was ringing within about a minute. And I actually pulled out a tape recorder and said, Preston, hold on a second, I'm going to record this conversation. And he kind of talked me off of that and said, whoa, hold on now, let's just relax, you know, we'll just have a casual conversation, let's talk about this. So I turned the tape recorder off. We did have the conversation. He sends me an email that basically says that he thinks I'm in federal violation of federal law, and he specifically says it's the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, passed in the early 80s. The thing about that is we went to the ACLU, to their national security project, and we talked to a guy named Ben Wisner, who's pretty well known over there, and he advised
us. He's Ed Snowden's lawyer, by the way, for the Civil Liberties Union.
And so he advised us, and what he said wasn't comforting. This law has never been used to prosecute journalists. It was intended to prosecute people who have signed confidentiality agreements working in the government and who have released information. But it's not for journalists. That being said, he said, it's obvious the Obama administration is trying to extend precedent in this area. And when they do it, they're not going to go after Bob Woodward. They're going to go after a couple of knuckleheads like yourself. So tread lightly, you know. He also said, that being said, if you go forward with this and you get into legal trouble, there's going to be a whole world community looking to support you on this. And so, I mean, that's very scary as a couple of independent journalists who had basically worked unpaid for the previous 3 months to try to put together this, you know, investigative piece. And the idea of us sort of being alone in the world and being charged with a crime by the Justice Department. I mean, I can understand why some journalists don't want to move forward with things like that. It has a real dampening effect.
So were you able to do your story in the end, or were you intimidated into not doing it? I mean, this is one of the challenges that, you know, national security journalism has. You know, at what point, you know, if you have the Washington Post behind you, the Guardian, the New York Times, that's one thing. But if you're an independent journalist and you're trying to act responsibly, you're at greater risk.
I mean, just this week, Human Rights Watch released a report about the dampening effect of the NSA surveillance. And that was the first thing I thought of. When that whole story came out a little over a year ago, I thought, how could a journalist like me, who maybe would have sources that are telling them things that they're really probably not supposed to be telling us, but that the public needs to know, how can you ever, with this system in place, be able to confidently tell a source, I can protect you? And I mean, I think that's become a huge problem now. We're seeing this sort of growth in the surveillance state that's become, like, I don't think the common man thinks about the fact that this is interfering with my ability to get the unvarnished truth from reporters.
Also, know? Don't you want to try to confirm what somebody says to get another source to confirm it? That's even more difficult.
Right. And now nobody wants to talk to anybody because we know we're all being spied on, essentially. You know, before it was difficult. Now it's next to impossible. But no, we moved forward with our story, and what we actually did was we did censor the names. We made the decision to do that, and we were going to raise a bigger stink about the fact that why won't the CIA let you know who these people are? And on the day we tried to censor, we released our podcast, we had a miscommunication with our webmaster. And we had asked that he post several communications between us and CIA on this obscure section of our site. And he made the mistake of posting the unredacted email, the same one I just described to you that was sent to Preston Golson. And it was out. And at that point, this sort of WikiLeaks-like website called Cryptome picked it up and posted it. And by the next day, John Cook, who's now the head of Glenn Greenwald's Intercept, he wrote an article for Gawker that basically told the full story of this woman. And that was the first time that we found out that she was the head of the Global Jihad Unit. I've since found out, by the way, from sources that she is at least one of the bases for the Jessica Chastain character in Zero Dark Thirty, because she was the person credited most internally with the successful assassination of Osama bin Laden.
All right. Now, some of this may sound obscure to people who haven't been following it in detail, but we do have a crisis underway now and since you started working, namely the fact that the CIA has acknowledged improperly spying on members of the Senate Oversight Committee. And Dianne Feinstein, the chairman, who has been very pro-CIA in all of this, gave a very impassioned speech challenging all of this. And now there's a battle over, you know, what gets redacted, what gets, I mean, censored, what doesn't. What's your take on all of this right now? Because this is posing the very issues that you've been dealing with privately for all these many months.
No, exactly. It's making headlines now, and it seems seems like this kind of isolated incident of certain 10 officers in the CIA kind of going rogue and not informing CIA Director John Brennan and spying on, like, senators who were investigating the crimes of the, yeah. the torture program. But, I mean, yes, this is a pattern, and it seems to go back every time to a small group of people, perhaps hundreds, that are inside CIA's counterterror center, and specifically this sort of group of, I would say, 15 key people that have sort of moved their way up and down the chain between the Bin Laden station, Global Jihad Unit, and counterterror center. But, you know, Dianne Feinstein, she went up on the Senate floor and she gave this one-hour speech, and what she was basically saying is, who's in charge of who here? We are the oversight committee to the CIA. And, you know, the thing is that when Leon Panetta first was named CIA director when Obama came into office, one of the very first things he did was go to Congress after reviewing all internal documents and letting them know, hey, I think our counterterror people lied to you on a number of occasions over the years. But the truth is, you can see a pattern. You go to 9/11, you go to the torture program of a small group of people in CIA misleading, we're not sure who, possibly misleading their own CIA officials, definitely misleading the White House, definitely misleading Congress.
And the public.
And the public, therefore.
So what about the media in all of this? Are they doing a good job in trying to monitor these particular events or not? I mean, it seems like, you know, it's a hard story to follow. And, you know, there has been some, you know, public interest journalism sites that have actually done a chronology of all of this. But you have to, you know, kind of be a detail junkie to follow all this, don't you? I mean, it's difficult.
You do. And that's why, you know, Adam Goldman, Matt Apuzzo, Jane Mayer, you know, there are good journalists, Lawrence Wright, who have, like, sort of been tracking this from the start. But as you say, you can't sort of jump into this midstream and expect to understand everything that's been going on. It is a very devil in the detail type of a story. And so I think most reporters just sort of chase whatever the latest lead is, get a couple sound bites from some officials and post the story. If you want the real story, you can get it, but you got to look a little deeper.
I mean, the other day, the publication with which Glenn Greenwald is associated, First Look Media, The Intercept, published a story which exposed the terror lists that have been compiled and the no-fly lists that have grown exponentially under the Obama administration.
Right.
They went to apparently the agency responsible for this and said, listen, we're running this story. It's going to say so-and-so and such. What's your comment? They said, we'll get back to you. In the meantime, they contacted apparently the Associated Press and gave them their story, in a sense, what they call spoiling the scoop. So now another organization, a journalistic organization, was being pitted against The Intercept for its coverage. Now, the AP ran a smaller story. The Intercept ran a longer story. But these are parts of the perils of how the media can be, if you will, manipulated in trying to get at these facts.
Yeah. I actually think the story of Zero Dark Thirty is a classic case of media manipulation, where the screenwriter Mark Boal was given this very exclusive access to a number of people inside CIA. I'm convinced Alfreda Bukowski was probably one of those people, and got told a very one-sided story. But he had, you know, he had an exclusive story, and he turned it into an Oscar-nominated film. But I feel like it was one of the CIA is meant to manipulate. It was created to manipulate, but it's intended to manipulate foreign governments.
Are you saying deception is its middle name?
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, that's exactly what Tom Kane, the chair of the 9/11 Commission, told us when we interviewed him in his New Jersey office. He said, hey, does it surprise you the CIA was brought up to lie? Well, it doesn't surprise me, but when we catch them... See, here's what I think is broken. Because you had the... You had the hearings in the late 70s that looked at, you know, all of these misdeeds by the CIA.
Including assassination plots.
Right. So this is nothing new. But what I think is new in the last 15 years is, at the time, the misdeeds were all misdeeds that had been greenlit by the White House, known to Congress for the most part. And so...
What was called the family jewels of the CIA, so-called family jewels, their darkest secrets.
Exactly. But what's happening in the last 15 years is you've got the CIA doing misdeeds where they are not doing them at the behest of the president. They're not doing them necessarily at the behest of Congress. They're sort of going off on their own, and they're using this incredible rise in secrecy that's happened over the last decade and a half to insulate themselves. They know they won't be caught, and if they are caught, they can play it the way they want it.
Like, I just reviewed the film Enemy of the State last night, you know, and what there seems to be there is a bureaucracy protecting itself and doing everything it can to prevent people from challenging it or not supporting its various legislative initiatives, which in the end translate into a lot of money for contractors and jobs, you know, in this bureaucracy.
A really important point, I think, is to realize that, you know, Alfreda Bukowski got to the CIA probably about 1991. And in 95, the guy who created what's called the Extraordinary Rendition Program, this is basically the non-judicial kidnap people around the world and disappear them into a black hole program, this guy's name was Mike Scheuer. He was given the opportunity in 95 to start the Bin Laden office, and he filled it entirely with, you know, originally it was 25 women, all very young, but most importantly, analysts with no field experience. So people who would sort of follow his lead. And the group within CIA was considered so odd that they got called the Manson family, and they were considered this sort of cult of extremists. So cut to, you know, the week after 9/11, and the CIA gets a huge increase in its budget. It gets made the front-running organization to run the war on terror, and everybody who's inside the Bin Laden office gets promoted into these important positions. So as the decades have, as the last 10 years have gone on, these people have now become part of the mainstream CIA, and because, you know, their philosophies have become part of the mainstream U.S. government policy. So the Manson family is now the CIA.
The Manson family is in charge. Ray, thank you so much, Ray Novoshelsky, for coming in and talking about your work. How can people see Press for Truth? I know it's online.
You can rent it on Netflix, buy it on Amazon. Check us out. Check out our Facebook page, Press for Truth official page.
So that's a way to follow this story in more detail. Ray is not a well-known journalist, but he's becoming better known because of his persistence, his diligence, and his desire to inform the people about a story that would otherwise be buried and is being buried, generally speaking. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. Thank you for listening. Stay with us for more.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
40% of stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
40% of stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
There you go. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, in studio and in New York City, and speaking by Skype with Michael Albert in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Michael Albert has been an activist for his whole life. His book, his autobiography, is quite interesting, called Remembering Tomorrow, From SDS to Life After Capitalism. It was published in 2007 by Seven Stories Press. He himself is a co-editor of ZNet, co-editor and co-founder of Z Magazine. He also co-founded the South End Press, has written numerous books and articles. He's an independent media person in every sense of the word, because he not only, in a sense, has an independent perspective, but he's created an institution that's managed to survive over all of these years to produce high-quality work and build an audience not only in the United States but around the world. Thank you for joining us, Michael.
Thank you, Danny, for having me.
And to begin this conversation for Media Channel, we're talking about the media and journalism. In the course of your life as somebody who's, in a sense, tried to offer other narratives, competing points of view, develop an analysis, where do you see the media in the structure of power in our country? How do you view it?
Well, if you if you take into account that obviously what happens is largely a function of, on the one hand, massive, powerful institutions, and on the other hand, what's in people's heads, that is to say, what large numbers of people believe and are willing to act on, the media is relevant insofar as it affects what's in people's heads. What are large numbers of people believing, and what are they willing to act on? So that's media per se. Then there's mainstream media and attempts to provide an alternative to it. But it's all important, because how else, beyond face-to-face talking, which is incredibly important, but beyond that, how else does do ideas spread? Well, they spread through communications via media.
So you set out, you didn't really study to do this. This wasn't your really first political task. You were an activist. You were protesting. I think, you know, we met at MIT. You were one of the student leaders of the protest against the war in Vietnam, against the Center for International Studies there. And yet you gravitated into kind of being a publisher and playing a media role. How did that happen? And tell us a little bit about, you know, the various outlets that you've helped create.
Well, in the very beginning of it, it was I worked on a book that I called What is to be Undone. It was sort of a look at various ideologies, obviously one of them being Leninism, quite critical of it, critical of other ideologies and proposing new ideas. And the woman who I was living with, Lydia Sargent, and I prepared the book for a very small publisher in Boston called Porter Sargent Press. And the experience of doing that taught us a lot, on the one hand, about, you know, publishing and preparing the actual physical material, and also about the shortcomings of existing media channels. And we got it into our heads that maybe we could do something to augment desirable alternative media channels. And so we began the endeavor to create South End Press. That was followed much later by Z Magazine, ZNet, the website, an institute that we did over the summer, Z Media Institute, books, videos, various kinds of projects, all cumulatively now called Z Communications.
Would I be right in saying that, you know, part of your approach to doing this was not just to offer articles, but to offer a perspective, to try to get people to think more deeply about economic issues, to get them to think more deeply about the way the world is organized? And in the course of, you know, your work, and I guess going back to your days at MIT, you became very closely associated with, collaborating with Noam Chomsky. Tell us a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, both of those things are true. Right from the beginning, the priority wasn't just, as the old saying goes, to understand the world, but to impact it. And I always felt that affecting social relations depended on having some vision of what you wanted and some strategy for getting it. So for me, the priority became, at least on the, you might call it the editorial side, the content side, conveying analysis of what is and why it's the way it is, but also vision about what might be and strategy about how to reach it. We had another parallel agenda, which was to create alternative media institutions, which by their very structure and by the way they operated would try to be consistent with the values in that perspective that you described. And yes, I met Noam very early on when I was a student at MIT, and he was a famous professor there, and we've been friends ever since, and interacted together in many ways. Mostly at the beginning, my publishing him, working on his books, in many instances sort of urging him to write, etc., and then since then, various other things.
Well, tell us about this a little bit, because you have a unique vantage point that I think very few other people have. You know, everybody's heard the name Noam Chomsky. Some people, you know, dismiss him. But so many people around the world admire him. You know, whenever he speaks, he packs auditoriums on campuses, you know, that have never seen a political activist. He's somehow managed to become a superstar. And yet he's extremely modest. He's extremely non-self-promoting, if you will. He's very common sense oriented. And at the same time, he's extremely smart. How does he do it? And how have you interacted with him?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, your fingers are on the answer to the how-to. It's just that in some ways it's sort of unbelievable, so people don't buy it. He is very smart, that's true. He's tremendous memory. He has a tremendous facility for pursuing an issue and getting to the heart of the matter, for making it clear by usually analogies which sort of break down resistance that people have to seeing. He's incredibly methodical. You're right that he's not in the least bit self-promoting. He doesn't even know what that means. He's a special character in the history. There's really no way to get around that.
Michael, just to continue this point for one second, you know, also, in my view, an incredibly generous, okay? I've seen him, you know, writing notes to students from who knows where, who write to him, he responds to them. People who are asking him to blurb their books, he responds to them. Various publishers, he may have books with one publisher, he doesn't mind doing a book for another one. He's very non-exclusive in that way. He's not very brand conscious, even though in the rest of the world he is seen as a brand.
Yeah, he doesn't know what a brand is. What you say is all quite true. Some of it gets interesting. He would give a talk, say, at a college in Mississippi, say, in the United States, and he'd get back and we'd be talking about it, and he would say, you know, if I have to go by my experiences, the country is ready to explode. I spoke to 1,500 people. There were 500 people outside trying to get in. Are there that many radicals in, or that many revolutionaries even in this one tiny area inside the state of Mississippi, inside the South in the United States? And my answer to him was no. You know, I wish it was true, but it's not. There are two kinds of people relating to you. That was the high point, I think, of the Gnome bandwagon, so to speak. And one kind of pure person was going for an event. It's a little like somebody who doesn't know any physics. If Stephen Hawking came to town, or in years past Albert Einstein came to town, they'd go to the event to just share in the luster of it. There's nothing wrong with that particularly, but that's one kind. But then there are other people who go and who read him and who do so because they are very sincerely and seriously interested in the substance, and they pursue it with great vigor. And so if you look at his impact, you know, it's peripheral on that first group of people, but on the second group of people, which is quite large, his impact is enormous. And you find that, we did a summer school that actually you taught at a number of times in Woods Hole, and, 70 people would come for a couple of weeks. And invariably, people, when they got to talking about how they got radicalized, part of it was almost always reading a Chomsky book, having it open their eyes, etc. So his impact has been enormous.
And yet he's not on TV a lot. I mean, he's not a regular on MSNBC. He's not on Fox. He's, you know, he has debated people who disagree with him on Israel and other issues, but he's not in the mainstream media, and yet he's known by the mainstream, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's not in the mainstream media in the United States. He is to a degree in other parts of the world. I haven't even had that experience. So I've gone on, television in Turkey on the main station for an hour. The rest of the world is a bit more open, particularly to people who aren't from the country in question and addressing it explicitly, than American media is. So, no, he is invisible in U.S. media, in U.S. mainstream media, to the extent that they can keep him that way. And we have many experiences with that. We used to, you know, at South Bend Press, we would be publishing his books. We would try and get reviews. He was in the Boston area. We would try and get reviews from the Boston Globe, and the Boston Globe review editors would tell us, well, no, it's not going to happen. And we would say, you know, we would make all these arguments and go on, and they would say, look, you have to understand something. The editor would say, you have to understand something. Even if you win all these arguments with me and you're doing a very good job of that, it doesn't matter because I'm not going to run it anyway. Because if I ran it, I'd lose my job. And that's a common kind of dynamic, which is very rarely, that's an unusual situation, unusual only in that the person, you know, was honest about it.
I heard it said, you know, well, the problem with Chomsky is he doesn't give good sound bites. In other words, when you ask him a question, he doesn't give you a nugget of an answer. He actually tries to explain his reasons for believing something, which takes more than 10 seconds.
Of course, and that's not the problem with Chomsky. That's a problem with American media. If you want to try and understand a complex phenomenon, either a policy, much less a set of institutions, much less a social structure, you have to spend a little time doing it, particularly if you're going to propose something which is contrary to what most people tend to parrot, most people tend to believe. So you can't offer an alternative perspective which is fundamentally different in a sound bite. It's impossible. And that's why sound bites are so highly valued, because it's impossible to say anything critical that's going to convey and get any place in a sound bite. You can probably do it, but it will have no substance. It won't have any supporting evidence. It won't be, its logic won't be evident. It'll just be the sound bite. And it'll go nowhere. And he refuses to do that, I think rightly. The trouble is we're not strong enough to force the media yet to have on bigger things, bigger formulations. And I just want to add one point to that. Sadly, I think this is overtaking alternative media, too. There's a tendency, and I think it has a lot to do with social media and Facebook and Twitter and the fragmentation of jumping around on the internet. And there's this inclination to think that we have to be short, shorter, and shortest, and that's the only way to communicate effectively. Whereas, by definition, it is a way to communicate ineffectively. You could be good at shortest, but you won't be communicating effectively. And so it's very sad the extent to which that is beginning to take over even progressive minds.
I mean, other people would look at it and say, gee, isn't that a shame? He never gets on, you know, X, Y, and Z. You know, we don't see him on TV a lot. He's so brilliant. He's so smart. Does he get discouraged by that or depressed by it?
Well, you know, if you realize that his existence is very much a mass of information from all over the world flowing to him, and immersing himself in that and dealing with that.
What's his
Then you ask yourself, well, what would he be upset by? Well, on the one hand, you have not getting on TV, and on the other hand, you have mass massacres. So, yeah, he doesn't like the characteristics and the features of American mainstream media, of course, but he's also caught up in, say, what's going on in Gaza and so on. And so he's, you know, many, many variables are at work in terms of assessing why one gets depressed or upset or angry.
Now let's turn to you, Michael, as somebody who's worked not just for him and not just around him, but by yourself, creating, you know, some really important and innovative ideas and theories and, you know, being involved to some degree in, you know, events in Nicaragua, traveling there, working now on Telesur, their television channel, helping them create an English language edition of it. How do you see your own career, your own trajectory in terms of all of this?
Danny, we're friends. I'll just be forthright. Too little. I don't know what else to tell you. I measure things not by comparing, say, what I've done or what I've achieved or what somebody else has done and what they've achieved to something much less, but to what's needed. And if you compare what we've done to what's needed, I'm afraid it comes out short.
Well, part of the reason it comes out short, in your view anyway, is that, from what I gather, you know, is that a lot of the independent media tried to be like the mainstream media. They organize themselves that way. They, you know, try to get advertising. They try to, they don't build a culture of resistance so much as a culture of subscriptions, if you will, or, you know, using petition campaigns and all the rest of it. You're much more, you know, into the grassroots. It's organizing, bottom-up approach.
Yeah, I mean, that's all quite true. I think, it might be idiosyncratic to me. I don't know. When I look around and I try to understand what's going on, to me, the left feels, over the past 40 or 50 years, a little bit like, say, a professional basketball or football team that has a attitude that it is not going to win, and having that attitude sort of frees you from the necessity to be really to work really hard, to be really careful, to try and get your activity to be as successful as possible. If you're going to lose anyway, then what you do is you sort of, at some level, you try and look good. And you try and get along with your friends, and you try and make an existence on the left. And I'm not trying to disparage. It may sound that way. I think it's understandable, but I don't think it's something to be, you know, dismissive of. But I think it's because we've constructed a movement which has rarely said what we want. It has rarely been clear about our aims. It has rarely been confident, and it doesn't exert the discipline that's necessary to take experiences, refine them, and do better, and continually do that. And so it's not surprising to me that, as I say, we've fallen short of creating a new world. We've fallen short of ending war. We've fallen short of, you know, eliminating capitalism and so on and so forth. It doesn't surprise me in the sense that I don't think, in some sense, we've ever tried. I think in a very real sense, we've tried to ameliorate some pain and create a milieu that's pleasant and favorable for opposition, but without the notion that we're going to win and that it is our responsibility to do so. And so we don't. And I think when that changes, our success rate will change also.
You know, at the same time, you know, you've remained pretty consistent in terms of your values and your beliefs. I don't think you've been jumping all over the place. You've gone deeper, not trying to please people so much as to trying to lead people to looking at things in a different way. How would you describe your own passions now as a communicator?
Well, I think they continue to be what they've always been. On the one hand, an event comes along and it's horrific and it needs explication and people need information about it and to get a clear understanding of what's going on. So, for example, what just recently happened in Gaza, or, you know, one can name all sorts of things. On the other hand, I think I spend a whole lot of time as well trying to enunciate a vision, trying to explain, for example, how an economy could work in a manner that would be without class division, without class rule, that would generate self-management for people, that would generate solidarity, and that would be equitable. And the same for other parts of life. So I'm a kind of a mix of trying to do vision, aims that can unify us and that can give our efforts some structure and some focus, and on the other hand, trying to explain what's going on. But you're right that my values, no, they haven't changed very much. I haven't done it, but I would be willing to wager, and this would be true for Noam too, if you went back all the way to 1966 or 67 or 68 and you came all the way forward, you would see refinement of the understanding and, elaboration of the features. But there's no major jumps. And the reason for that is because there's nothing very complicated about it, right? In other words, wanting people to be able to control their own lives. Well, what's it going to change to? Wanting people not to be able to control their own lives? Not likely. Wanting equitable economic relations, relations in which people get a fair share of the output of society and have fair circumstances. Well, what's that going to change to? The opposite? No. You know, so the basic underlying values aren't going to change. The few cases in which that happens, David Horowitz, you know, people like that, to my mind, it generally represents just a complete co-optational sellout to try and make good in this mainstream world. But other than that, I can't see why anybody would do it.
And a sort of suck up. But anyway, what I think, you know, is you've been very brave in my estimation. You haven't sort of gone for the easy, you know, take. You're brilliant technologically. You're entrepreneurial. You're a great organizer. You really know how to run a business even. Lydia Sargent, your partner, is so creative and so able, you know, to basically, you know, come up with original ideas and ways of presenting information and the like. That's very impressive. You know, I have a lot of respect for that. But at the same time, you know, aren't you facing the same issues? You know, where's the money going to come from? How am I going to sustain this? You know, it's difficult.
Yes, it's very difficult. I really appreciate the kind words, Danny. Thank you. It is very difficult. The money part of it is very difficult. And at the risk of being a little bit repetitive, think of the two approaches. One approach says left media, let's take media, but you could also take organizing efforts. Left media lacks for resources. It lacks for money. What's the solution? Well, one approach would be each media outfit trying to find a way to navigate through those very difficult levels of relative poverty individually. And another approach would be trying to do something much more collective. We have tried to do the collective approach over and over and over, even as we also have no choice but to try and navigate, you know, without it having taken off. But the number of others who do that is relatively small. And I think it's cynicism. I don't think people don't do that because they think it's a bad idea or it's evil or there's something wrong with it. Nothing like that. They don't pursue it in that manner because they assume it won't succeed.
You know,
the only way they can succeed is by going it alone. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy
When you're saying this, Michael, you know, I had an image come into my mind. I didn't expect it to, but nevertheless, you know, the image of Peter Gabriel, a musician, on stage, and at a certain point in his show, he puts his hands up and he falls back into the audience. He just falls into the audience. He could fall on his head, okay? And the audience catches him, and they hold him up, okay? And they support him, he becomes part of them. And it's a symbolic kind of marriage, if you will, between the people who love his music and his trust in those people. And I think of that image somehow when I hear what you're saying, because you've made so many efforts to create, you know, participatory networks and organizations. And, you know, I think that the work that you're doing and the work that you've done is not only important for the content, which is itself impressive, but it's important for the model, for attempting to do it another way. And I think that's why you've attracted support from all over the world, even if not enough in the United States. And I think that's why, you know, Noam Chomsky has been such a supporter of yours as well, because he recognizes not only your brilliance, but your sincerity and your willingness to keep plugging
along. Danny,
stop. I'm finished. I'm sorry. Send a dollar, send a nickel, whatever. But I think it's an important model, and that's why I wanted to have you on. Michael Albert, thank you so much for joining me. We will send you the podcast of this interview and hope so much to stay in touch with you. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. Thank you for joining me.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank.
Thank you so much for joining us here on PRN-FM checking all this out later on mediachannel.org, where these podcasts will be posted. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Please visit Media Channel and tell us what you think about it, and also tell your friends about it as well. Back again next week. Stay with us.